What if the most prestigious wine in your cellar was a total lie? Poured from a relabeled $12 bottle and sold to you for $30,000. This is the story of Rudy Corniawan, a man who turned deception into a luxury business and built the world's greatest wine scam. He didn't just con billionaires. He rewrote the rules of trust, taste, and status. This is a masterclass in manipulation, and you're about to drink it in. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1, The Velvet Pour. I remember the wine before I remembered the man. It was a 1947 Chateau Lafleur Magnum, or so the label claimed, passed carefully from gloved hands to a crystal decanter at a private tasting in Manhattan's Upper East Side. The cork smelled like wealth. The legs on the wine clung to the glass like silk. The room, filled with soft jazz and whispered French, leaned forward as the pour began. Everyone was pretending not to care how much it cost. Everyone was pretending to know what they were tasting. I was the only one pretending to be a collector. I was really there chasing a name, Rudy Corniawan. The man was a ghost in these circles. A myth. Some called him Dr. Conti because of his obsession with Domaine de la Romanée Conti. Others knew him as the soft-spoken Indonesian kid with a West Coast smile and an East Coast budget. But to the inner wine world, he was the one person who could conjure rare vintages out of nowhere, like a magician with a corkscrew. And for years, no one asked how. I wasn't there for the Lafleur. I was there because a French winemaker had whispered something to me 3 months earlier in Burgundy. That wine you Americans bid $50,000 on, we never made it. That's when I knew Rudy wasn't just bending the truth. He was fermenting it. The tasting was held in a penthouse that overlooked Central Park. Floor-to-ceiling windows, polished floors, and enough oak and marble to make Versailles blush. Men in bespoke suits and women in gallery-ready dresses sipped with curled lips and nodded with overpracticed elegance. Rudy wasn't even there. But his legend was. Every bottle in the room had passed through his hands. Every guest had bought something from him, drank something curated by him, or wanted to. I moved through the crowd slowly, listening. No one questioned provenance. They whispered admiration. The consensus was clear. Rudy knows. That was the manipulation. Not the wine. Not the labels. It was trust. A man with no vineyard, no certifications, no winemaking history. Just a taste for the luxurious and the confidence of someone who belonged. He made billionaires feel lucky just to know him. 2 days later, I landed in Los Angeles. That's where Rudy lived, Beverly Hills. A two-story home with a vaulted wine cellar below ground. The kind you build if you're planning to impress people or fool them. I wasn't sure which yet. Outside, you'd never suspect a crime was fermenting. His house was beige. His neighbors were retired CEOs. But inside, according to a source, there were boxes of empty bottles, rolls of fake vintage labels, and an entire counterfeiting lab disguised as a wine hobbyist's workspace. I stood outside his gate for 15 minutes, debating whether to ring the bell. He didn't know me yet. I wasn't press. Not officially. I had a burner email and a tip from an ex-auctioneer. That's all. But then I remembered what he once told Wine Spectator. Wine is like a beautiful woman. You don't ask where she came from. You just enjoy her. That was it. That was his whole philosophy. No questions. Just taste. Just trust. That night, I went back to my hotel and started digging. His real name wasn't Rudy. It was Zhen Wang Huang. His visa had expired. His fortune was borrowed. And yet he'd sold more rare wine in 5 years than some vineyards had made in a century. The next day, I tracked down one of his first victims. He didn't call himself that. Rudy gave me access to bottles I'd never dreamt of tasting, he said. If it was fake, I don't want to know. That line sat with me. I don't want to know. Manipulation isn't always forced. Sometimes it's just gently uncorked and passed around until everyone is too tipsy on the idea to care about the truth. By the end of that week, I had receipts, shipping records, forged certificates, vintage dates that predated vineyard ownerships. He once sold a 1945 Clos Saint-Denis, from a vineyard that didn't even exist until the 1980s. He didn't just make up numbers. He made up history. And people drank it. The final piece came when I found someone who used to work in Rudy's kitchen. Not the cellar, the actual kitchen. She told me about the nights he'd mix wines on the stove like potions. Cheap Napa cabs blended with low-end Burgundy. A drop of something old, a splash of something sugary. Then he'd test it, pour it into a decanter, and say, "This tastes like money." I asked her if she thought he knew it was a crime. She shrugged. I think he believed the illusion mattered more than the liquid. And maybe that's what this whole story is. A velvet pour. A slow trickle of lies, dressed in oak and silk, passed hand to hand until it became too expensive to question. This wasn't just about wine. It was about the psychology of prestige, the price of trust, and the kind of manipulation that doesn't shout, it swirls. Chapter 2, The Label Lies. If you ever want to understand a con artist, start with what they touch the most. For Rudy Corniawan, it wasn't the wine, it was the label. And by the time I found one of his old suppliers in East LA, a man who ran a print shop out of the back of a mechanic garage, I understood that Rudy's empire was built not on flavor or grapes, but on the illusion of authenticity, pressed on aged paper. He wanted the edges slightly yellowed, the printer told me. Sometimes he'd ask me to rough them up with sandpaper, make them look like they'd been through decades of humidity. They weren't labels. They were time machines. By 2004, Rudy was already moving millions of dollars worth of wine through elite auction houses. He consigned collections that stunned even the experts. Rare Burgundies, impossible Lafleurs, entire verticals of DRC vintages that didn't exist in documented records. But no one questioned him, because the labels were immaculate, because they looked real. That's what blew my mind. These weren't drunk-on-the-job mistakes. These were curated counterfeits. The deeper I went, the more I realized Rudy didn't just fake wine. He engineered belief. Let me explain. Labels were only part of it. He also had custom corks stamped with fake estate markings. Old bottles sourced from restaurant trash and collector cast-offs, scrubbed clean and re-aged with dust or smoke. Capsules and wax seals, melted and resealed with impressive precision. Even the font sizes were meticulously matched to vintage designs. When a vineyard changed its serif or italic weight in 1986, Rudy knew. He wasn't just copying. He was reconstructing forgotten eras. I found one collector in Connecticut who still had an unopened bottle from Rudy's first big auction lot. "I can't bring myself to open it," he admitted. "Even if it's fake, it's perfect." That's when I realized Rudy didn't just deceive people. He seduced them. He created something too emotionally valuable to destroy, even in truth. I needed to know how he sourced so many empty bottles. That answer came in the form of a former waiter from a Michelin-starred restaurant in Beverly Hills. He told me Rudy had a quiet deal with multiple sommeliers. Whenever high-end bottles were finished at the table, Rudy's team would offer complimentary disposal. They were never thrown away. They were recycled into wealth. But the masterstroke wasn't physical. It was psychological. Rudy understood something most grifters don't. That if you build context, people won't need proof. And he built that context with the most elite company in the wine world. By hosting tastings with sommeliers, journalists, hedge fund managers. By quoting obscure tasting notes from 19th century vintages. By moving fast and charming faster. One auctioneer told me Rudy would often say, "If you wait too long, the bottle disappears." That urgency, that fear of missing out, that was the real vintage he was selling. It wasn't long before I got my hands on a wine authentication report done by a forensic lab the FBI had used during their eventual case against him. They tested glue under one label. It matched a brand manufactured in Indonesia in the 1990s. They found discrepancies in cork fiber density, bottle glass patterns, and even barcode shapes. And yet, those bottles had already passed through Christie's, Acker Merrill & Condit, and Sotheby's with flying colors. Why? Because nobody wanted to believe that the man pouring them 1945 Mouton was lying. Because his labels, and the stories he wrapped around them, were more powerful than science. Later that year, I attended a private tasting in Napa, where a collector opened a 1929 Domaine Poncet Clos Saint-Denis from Rudy's collection. As soon as the cork popped, I saw the winemaker flinch. "We never produced Clos Saint-Denis before 1982, he said. The room went quiet. Then someone laughed. Then someone poured. No one cared. They were already drunk on prestige. That's what I learned. People don't drink wine. They drink stories. And Rudy Corniawan, he was a master storyteller, using adhesive, paper, and myth to manipulate the world's most powerful palates. He didn't just forge labels. He forged desire. And by the time anyone questioned the truth, they'd already toasted to the lie. Chapter 3. Bidding Wars and Blind Eyes. The first time I watched a Rudy bottle hit the auction floor, I felt like I was witnessing a spiritual event. Not a sale. Not commerce. A ritual. Men in tailored tuxedos raised paddles like believers in a wine-soaked church. Their gospel wasn't faith, it was scarcity. Their God, a 26-year-old wine savant who had never worked a single day in a vineyard. But the belief in Rudy was absolute. The auction was held at Acker Merrill and Condit, one of the oldest wine merchants in America, now playing kingmaker to the new elite. The venue was a high-ceiling ballroom in Midtown Manhattan, carpeted in burgundy, lit by soft chandeliers that made everything and everyone feel aged to perfection. I stood near the back of the room, not bidding, just watching. A bottle of 1982 Petrus went for $38,000. A Jeroboam of Romani Conti, allegedly from 1945, $120,000. Then came the moment everyone waited for. Lot 138. Six bottles of 1971 Domaine de la Romani Conti, Grand Cru, courtesy of Mr. Rudy Corniawan. Gasps. Paddles up. $50,000. $60,000. $75,000. No one even asked how he got them. That was the trick. Provenance was no longer about paperwork. It was about personality. Rudy wasn't selling wine. He was selling himself. Charming. Soft-spoken. Always grinning like he knew a secret. Auctioneers loved him. Buyers worshipped him. Critics toasted to his taste. He didn't just show up with wine. He showed up with story. Behind closed doors, he worked the auction houses like a seasoned investor. He knew when to withhold. He knew when to leak limited offerings. He created bidding frenzies by floating rumors about what might go up for sale. One insider told me he was a master of the slow tease. Rudy could take a $300 bottle, wrap it in a whisper of 1959, and suddenly it was worth $30,000. Another said it wasn't fraud, it was theater. I met a former Acker employee in a Brooklyn wine bar years after the scandal broke. He told me Rudy would sometimes place a fake bid through a proxy, just high enough to drive up interest. We called it auction ping pong. Someone starts the bidding war. Everyone else joins to not look poor. It was psychological warfare in a suit and tie. But the most disturbing part wasn't Rudy. It was the auction houses themselves. They had every reason to vet, every reason to slow down, every reason to question. And yet they did nothing, because the sales were just too good. In 1 year alone, Rudy's wine lots brought in over $35 million at auction. The commissions were massive, the headlines glowing. No one wanted to be the first to say, "This doesn't smell right." And even if they did, they'd already been drinking. At one point, Rudy sold a set of magnums from the 1920s. The labels were flawless. The glass even had tiny air bubbles, the kind that would only appear in pre-war French glassmaking. One collector bid $78,000. Later, a lab found that the glass was American, and the labels had been baked in a toaster oven to simulate age. Rudy never flinched. He simply said, "Sometimes bottles live strange lives." I interviewed a hedge fund manager in Tribeca who once spent nearly $500,000 on Rudy's wines. I asked if he felt conned. He looked at me, shrugged, and said, "Honestly, it was fun. The chase, the tasting, the idea that I was drinking history. What's that worth to you?" That was the moment it hit me. The victims weren't victims because they were fooled. They were victims because they chose belief over doubt. And that was the genius of Rudy Corniawan. He weaponized the fear of missing out. He exploited the rich man's desire to feel chosen. And he turned the auction block into a stage for manipulation, dressed in velvet and varnish. As I left that night, I passed the glass display case by the exit. Inside sat a bottle labeled 1945 Mouton Rothschild, verified provenance. And right next to it, a small gold plaque engraved with Rudy's name. I stared at it for a long time, because I couldn't decide what was more intoxicating, the wine, or the lie that made it feel real. Chapter 4, The High of Exclusivity. Exclusivity is the drug no one admits they're addicted to. In the luxury world, it's stronger than money, more intoxicating than alcohol, and more blinding than love. And Rudy Corniawan? He dealt it in crystal glasses and handwritten tasting notes. He wasn't just selling wine. He was selling access, to a world just out of reach, a circle of rare knowledge, a flavor no one else could describe because no one else was invited. And that was the manipulation. I first got into one of Rudy's infamous tastings by pretending to be a producer for a luxury lifestyle magazine. I used a fake email, an expensive handbag I couldn't afford, and just the right tone of disinterested wealth. The tasting was held in a mansion off Mulholland Drive. Gated, guarded, the kind of place you'd rent for a political fundraiser or a discreet cult initiation. Every car in the driveway was either German, Italian, or old money American. Inside, it smelled like money and lavender. There were only 12 of us, mostly men in crisp blazers and women with diamonds that didn't move when they did. Everyone knew Rudy. Everyone greeted him like royalty. And he moved through the room like a ghost with charm. Quiet, always smiling, always watching. Then the wine came out. We tasted a 1959 Romani Conti first. Rudy poured it himself. No one spoke until the glass was empty. Incredible, someone whispered. Transcendent, said another. I swirled it, held it to my nose. It was good. It was very good. But something was off. It tasted like too much, like a performance in a glass. But no one else seemed to care. They weren't tasting the wine. They were tasting the privilege of being in that room. That was the high Rudy gave people. He made them feel chosen, special, elevated, like they were sipping the past through a straw made of trust. And when you feel chosen, you stop asking questions. Later, I found out that same wine, the 59 DRC, had been assembled from three different bottles of low-end Burgundy and a dash of sugar. He aged it in a decanter for 2 days before sealing it and chilling it to mask the inconsistencies. That's how far he went. Not to trick the taste buds, to trick the ego. One collector I spoke to in Hong Kong described Rudy as a prophet of the palate. Another in Miami told me, without irony, drinking Rudy's wine was like touching God. They didn't just admire him, they needed him. Because exclusivity is only real if it's confirmed by someone who appears to know more than you. And Rudy played that role perfectly. I tracked down one of his former collaborators, a sommelier who helped organize the guest lists for those tastings. He told me the invites were always strategic. It wasn't about who had money. It was about who had influence. A hedge fund guy here, a critic there, a couple celebrities for sparkle. It was all designed to create an atmosphere of legitimacy through social validation. And the irony? None of them knew anything about the wine. They knew about each other. And Rudy used that to anchor his illusion in prestige. At one point during the tasting, I stepped outside for air. Rudy followed, holding a glass of wine and a cigarette he didn't light. He leaned on the railing, looked out over the city, and said, "You know what the richest people want?" I looked at him. To feel like something wasn't meant for anyone else. Like it was only for them. That's the real flavor. Not oak, not berries. Just exclusivity. Then he smiled, took a sip, and walked back inside. That night, I wrote in my notes, "He doesn't con people. He curates their delusion. And that's what made him dangerous. He didn't just understand how to fake wine. He understood how to fake importance and deliver it by the glass." I thought about that later, when I watched a collector cry after finding out his $250,000 seller was a fraud. Not because of the money, because of what it meant to him. Because Rudy had made him feel rare, and that feeling was now gone. Exclusivity is the most elegant form of control. And Rudy Corniawan? He was a sommelier of the soul. Chapter 5. The Ponset Confrontation. Every great con eventually meets its reckoning. And Rudy Corniawan's didn't come from the FBI, or a billionaire collector, or some Hollywood expose. It came from a quiet man in Burgundy with dirt under his fingernails and his family name stamped on a label. His name was Laurent Ponset, and he knew his vineyard and his wines like a father knows his child. And one day, while reading a New York auction catalog, he saw a bottle listed under his family's brand. 1929 Clos Saint-Denis, Domaine Ponset. The problem? Domaine Ponset didn't start bottling Clos Saint-Denis until 1982. Ponset flew to New York the next morning. Not called. Not emailed. Flew. I met him years later in Burgundy. We sat on his porch, surrounded by rows of vines in silence. He poured me a glass of his 2005 vintage and told me the story. "I didn't go there to accuse," he said. "I went there to stop a lie." The auction was hosted by Acker Merrill and Condit, the same house that had elevated Rudy into the wine stratosphere. they were preparing to sell several bottles of vintage Poncet wines, all traced to Rudy's collection. Poncet walked into the venue like a man stepping into his own crime scene. He pulled the auctioneer aside. "These bottles are fake," he said. "We never made them." There was hesitation, embarrassment, panic, then cancellation. The lots were pulled within minutes. But Rudy wasn't panicking. He was calm, cool. He told the press, "Sometimes old bottles have mysterious pasts. I don't know how I got them. Maybe I bought them at an estate sale. Who knows?" He shrugged it off like a mislabeled package, as if fraud could be accidental. Poncet wasn't fooled. He began his own investigation. Old invoices, cork manufacturing dates, archive label designs. He traced Rudy's wine back to a tangled trail of vague provenance and unverifiable sales. Every lead ended with Rudy. That's when other winemakers began whispering. First in France, then in Napa, then in Hong Kong. Bottles that shouldn't exist were surfacing at elite tastings. Bottles that had been lost to time were suddenly available, but only from one source. "There's only one person selling ghosts," someone told me. The wine world operates on a fragile ecosystem of trust and tradition. For a man like Rudy to survive, he needed the silence of auctioneers, the excitement of collectors, and the absence of questions. But Poncet broke that system. He didn't just expose the lie. He refused to let the lie become legend. I tracked down one auction house employee who had worked during the Poncet confrontation. He told me, "You have to understand, Rudy had momentum. Nobody wanted to stop the train, until Poncet stepped on the tracks. After the incident, the cracks began to spread. More experts started inspecting Rudy's wines. Labs were hired. Corks were dissected. Labels were ultraviolet tested. And with each test, the illusion unraveled. One forensic expert told me, it was like testing holy water and finding sink water with red dye. But even then, Rudy didn't retreat. He doubled down. He hosted more tastings. He appeared in more interviews. He smiled through every question. Wine is subjective, he said. What matters is the experience. That was his shield. Not logic. Philosophy. He wasn't defending truth. He was defending feeling. And for years, that was enough. But Laurent Poncet didn't let go. He worked with international investigators. He fed evidence to law enforcement. He turned whispers into a paper trail. And slowly, methodically, Rudy's myth collapsed under the weight of facts. I asked Poncet, before I left, if he felt proud of what he did. He shook his head and said, "Pride? No. Sadness. Because we wanted to believe him. We wanted to believe someone young and brilliant had found forgotten treasures. But he didn't find anything. He just lied better than the rest." That was the moment I truly understood Rudy's manipulation. He didn't just forge bottles. He forged belief, in history, in rarity, in legacy. And Laurent Poncet? He reminded the world that even in wine, the truth has a vintage too. Chapter 6. The FBI comes for dinner. It wasn't the forged labels. It wasn't the fake vintages or the fraudulent tasting notes or the manipulated auction results. What finally brought Rudy Corniawan down was a dinner invitation. A quiet man from the bureau, a steakhouse in Los Angeles, and a simple question, "Do you believe in provenance?" That was how the feds started circling Rudy. Not with a SWAT team, not with sirens, with silverware and patience. The agent's name was James Wynn, FBI White Collar Division. Tall, ex-military, slow to blink. He'd been tracking financial crimes for over a decade, hedge fund frauds, art scams, luxury laundering. But he told me Rudy's case was different. Most con artists are messy. Rudy was artistic. It started with tips from winemakers like Laurent Poncet, emails from angry collectors, and inconsistencies in shipping logs. But none of it stuck, yet, until Rudy got greedy. In late 2006, Rudy borrowed $3 million from a California wine merchant named Bill Koch. Yes, that Koch, one of the wealthiest men in America. He offered rare bottles as collateral. Koch's team inspected the bottles. They found immediate red flags. Wrong fonts, inaccurate vineyard info, corks that didn't match the glass. They brought in forensic wine experts. Their verdict? Roughly 90% of Rudy's cellar was counterfeit. Koch wasn't just angry. He was strategic. He filed lawsuits. He went public. And he called the FBI. That's when things accelerated. Agent Wynn told me they started quietly building a case. Shipping records, financial statements, lab reports. They followed the glue, the corks, the invoices. but what they needed was access. So they set the trap. In early 2012, Rudy agreed to host a private tasting for a small group of elite collectors and one art consultant, who was really an undercover FBI operative. The dinner was elegant, the wines were legendary, and the documents Rudy handed over, provenance certificates, sourcing letters, were complete fiction. But he didn't flinch. He poured wine. He smiled. He described the minerality of a bottle that didn't exist. And the agent just nodded, took notes, and waited. On March 8, 2012, just before dawn, the FBI knocked on Rudy's door in Arcadia, California. He opened in a t-shirt and pajama pants. Inside, they found stacks of counterfeit labels, inkjet printers still warm, bottles soaking in bathtubs to remove existing labels, glue stamps, corks, capsules, wax, heat guns, foil, handwritten recipes for blending cheaper wines. It wasn't just a con. It was a factory, a criminal winery hiding in plain sight. I got access to the arrest warrant through a contact in federal court. What struck me wasn't just the inventory list. It was the precision. Rudy had dates, ratios, targets. He knew which collectors preferred Burgundy, who liked Bordeaux, who never checked corks, who drank fast and who cellared for show. He wasn't just a scammer. He was a psychologist with a wine rack. After the arrest, Rudy offered no real explanation. No remorse. He said, "I guess I just got carried away. That was it. No confession. No drama. Just a man calmly watching his empire fall apart." At his trial, federal prosecutors laid out the full operation. Billionaires testified. Auction houses denied responsibility. Wine experts gave technical lectures on cork elasticity. But what hit hardest was the emotion. One collector broke down on the stand. "It wasn't about the money," he said. "It was about being part of something historic. And now that's gone." That was Rudy's final twist. He didn't just steal dollars. He stole meaning. The jury took less than 2 hours. Guilty. Wire fraud. Mail fraud. Multiple counts. Rudy was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. The first person in U.S. history convicted of wine fraud. I interviewed Agent Nguyen again, years after the case closed. I asked him what he thought Rudy's true motive was. He paused, then said, "Some people want money. Some people want fame. Rudy just wanted to be someone. And the wine world gave him a script." In the end, the FBI didn't just arrest a counterfeiter. They uncorked a truth that the wine world didn't want to admit. That prestige can be forged. That trust can be bottled. And that sometimes what we drink isn't what gets us drunk. Chapter 7. Bottled Illusions. Years later, I returned to New York to meet with one of Rudy Corniawant's earliest customers, a billionaire hedge fund manager who asked me not to use his name. We met in a dim private dining room above a Fifth Avenue steakhouse. The kind of place with napkins thick as towels and vintage cognac no one drinks, just displays. He poured us both a glass of real Romani Conti from 1990. Verified. Source direct. Unopened since release. I watched him swirl the wine, inhale deeply, then ask me, "Do you know what it tastes like now?" I said no. "Nothing," he said. "Because I don't trust it anymore." That was the collateral damage no one calculated. Rudy didn't just fake wine. He contaminated certainty. He made people question their memories. He made them question taste. He made them question each other. After Rudy's conviction, the wine world tried to seal the cork on his legacy. Auction houses implemented tighter verification protocols. Labs were hired. Wine authentication startups surged. But the truth is, many of Rudy's fakes are still out there. In cellars. In private collections. In dusty racks beneath billionaires' vacation homes. They sit in silence, untasted, unconfirmed, unwelcome. Because no one wants to know. There's something uniquely cruel about what Rudy did. He didn't just defraud banks or businesses. He defrauded stories. He preyed on nostalgia, aspiration, and pride. He made people feel extraordinary, then ripped the floor out from under them. And somehow, that was the point. During my research, I found a letter Rudy once wrote to a collector in Singapore. It was short, handwritten in blue ink, signed with a flourish. "Wine is meant to be enjoyed, not dissected. If it tastes amazing, why ruin it with doubt?" That line stuck with me. Because that was his philosophy, wasn't it? If the illusion feels real enough, is it still a lie? I visited his old house in Arcadia. It's been resold twice since the FBI raid. The new owners had no idea who he was. The wine cellar was emptied, turned into a home gym. but in the garage, wedged behind a stack of boxes, I found an old shipping crate. Inside was a single empty bottle labeled 1947 Lafleur Magnum, the same wine that started it all for me. The label was curling. The cork had cracked. The bottle was flawless. A lie that aged better than truth. I took it with me, not as evidence, not as a trophy, but as a reminder that in a world obsessed with prestige and provenance, sometimes all it takes is one person, with a printer, a palette, and a smile, to rewrite reality. And maybe that's what manipulation really is. Not screaming, not scamming, just a velvet pour, a moment that makes you feel chosen. A story too elegant to question. A taste you want to believe.